I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Tonight's video, we are diving into the story of a retired police detective and the three times that he had encountered true evil. And what he witnesses will terrify you. If you're new to the channel, subscribe. Click on that bell and smash that thumbs up and tell a friend. Now, let's get spooky. I'm a retired major crimes detective, and I've seen true evil three times in my career. All three were in the last decade of my career. I spent 12 years walking the beat before I had the opportunity to step in and assist a detective and a CSI on a double homicide. Through my numerous connections from years on the streets, we managed to get several leads that led to the arrests of the guilty. I moved out of patrol and spent a decade investigating sex crimes, arsons, and armed robberies. I took advanced training seminars and workshops, studying past cases and offender modalities. I worked with the drug squads on several assaults and the occasional murder before finding myself stepping in for a retiring detective. I was familiar with his partner, Connolly, and we became a good team. I bring this all up to emphasize that I've seen some horrifying shit in my 30 years on the force. Images I'll never shake. People who still haunt my dreams. I could honestly say that most of the criminals I've put away haven't been evil. They've all been motivated by something, however benign, to commit their acts. Then there are some that are on the fence. The ones that take violent crimes further than would typically be the case. And then there are those that dream up horrific atrocities to be inflicted on the world around them, because why not? Patty Wilson fell somewhere beyond the shades of your typical serial killer. She was the first person I encountered on the job who I could reliably say had true evil in her. Patty was an RN that had moved into the OBGYN and birthing clinic in one of the city's lower-class neighborhoods. This particular clinic had a terrible miscarriage and stillbirth rate, but the numbers were fudged and kept hidden. Eventually, people in the neighborhood started talking, and word got out of how many deaths there were. Our station was contacted, and normally this type of thing would land on another desk. But we were short-staffed, so Conley and I were brought in. Our investigation led us to Patty, and we found that in her 23 years at the clinic, there had been over 2,000 miscarriages. She had been giving a chemical cocktail to the expectant mothers, claiming it would help them sleep. Instead, it gradually killed the fetus as it grew. We also discovered that after several dozen healthy births, Patty would take the baby away to be cleaned up, but would return with the horrible news that the baby had died shortly after being delivered. Our investigations into that didn't lead anywhere concrete, but one of the threads we were pulling on led us to believe that Patty had been lying to the mothers, telling them their baby had died, when in fact, the baby was healthy but was shipped off to the highest bidder. A live baby on the black market could fetch a tidy sum, whether for organ harvesting, stem cells, or something more deviant and horrific. We believed it was racially motivated, as almost all the miscarriages and stillbirths occurred exclusively with black parents, but Patty denied it all. I remember watching Patty in our first interview with her. Her face was normal and moved expressively as she spoke and answered our questions. But her eyes didn't. They were empty, black holes, and the longer you stared into them, the more uncomfortable you became. Even after the trial, which had her served with multiple life sentences, Patty denied any wrongdoing. The case where I witnessed true evil, it fractured into an investigation involving multiple events. Conley and I were called in to investigate an attack on a beach volleyball tournament. On the city's largest beach, there was a national tournament with over 300 teams playing on 50 courts over the course of the weekend. The ages were from 12 to 65 and were both men and women. During morning warm-ups before the first game of the day, one scream turned into two screams, turned into 100 screams. Over one-third of the players needed immediate medical attention. Their feet, ankles, knees, thighs, hips, stomachs, and in some cases up to their shoulders and face, were covered in deep, gushing cuts. Someone had gone to the beach the night before the tournament and brought hundreds of small flat pieces of wood with razor blades sticking up from the centers in an upside-down capital T shape. The wood was dug into the sand, with the blade's sharp end pointing upward, and hidden just under the surface so no one would see them. It must have taken hours to set up. There were no deaths, but the damage that was caused resulted in hundreds of injuries, and several dozen athletic young adults with sliced Achilles tendons and a dwelling future in sports. As with every investigation, we started off at the crime scene and worked our way outwards in tight, concentric circles. While the CSIs were combing the beach, Conley and I were interviewing the people who ran the tournament, looking for any enemies or people who might want to target them, in this tournament in particular. But those led nowhere. Sadly, the CSIs fared no better. The entire crime scene was awash. There were so many footprints and shoe and sandal prints in the sand, it was impossible to search for tracks. And the actual razor blades and pieces of wood had been doused in bleach before being placed in their small dugouts. There was no security cameras on the beach, and the lone one that was in the parking lot didn't capture any cars between the hours of midnight and 7 a.m. Our phones were ringing off the hook with tips, but there was no real leads. After a month, we were nowhere in the investigation. Then a new investigation came in, and our hamstrung department got even tighter. Conley and I took it on as well. At a senior's home along the city's waterfront, a fire had started in the basement. Because of the accelerants used, it quickly overtook the first two floors. From there, the rest of the 8-story building went up. 22 residents and 9 staff died in the fire, all from smoke inhalation. We scoured the under-damaged security footage, but again found no suspects around the parking lots or front entrance. The footage from the rear of the building was destroyed, so we couldn't check it. Then a third investigation dropped onto our desks. This time, there was a mass poisoning in a junior high school cafeteria. There were 23 deaths, 15 of which were students, and over 100 severe injuries. Our investigation showed that someone had stealthily broken into the school overnight and poisoned every piece of food in the cafeteria stockroom, fridge, and freezer with arsenic. It was a miracle more people didn't die. All the school's exterior cameras were working, and after scoring them for clues, we finally found one at the back doors. The footage captured someone dressed in all black, with a hood and ski mask over his face. He used a small set of lock-picking tools to enter the back door which led to the kitchen. He used the same door to exit and ran off across the soccer field towards the water. And everything made sense. The beach volleyball courts, the senior's home, and now this junior...
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
High. They all backed out onto the water. The school itself had taken advantage of that fact by introducing students to rowing, kayaking, sailing, swimming, and other sports and activities on the open sea. And the seniors' home was partially marked based on its incredible view of the water. We emphasized the three mass crimes were committed by the same individual. We marked all three locations on a map and scanned down the coast for all the marinas and harbors. Then we went back through all the routes and picked out various waterfront hotspots we knew would have footage of their exteriors. Using the dates of the three incidents, we cross-checked the footage to try to find any repeat boats on the nights in question. We watched a lot of footage. There was only one boat that stood out. A large, old black speedboat being driven by a lone individual we couldn't make out details of. A red light glowed from inside the cabin. Conley and I got pictures of the boat printed and went back to check the marinas and harbors. None of the docks we went to had the particular boat or had records of it, which made us think it was docking at a private residence. I spoke to one of my friends in narcotics named Waco, and he brought up the drug boats that had been populating the cove near the last dock we visited. It turns out that many drug users in our city had been moving away from alleyways and SROs and onto small dinghies and drug boats, turning them into floating pill houses. The boats were harder for cops to break up or investigate, and you could float into a cove or out to a nearby channel for up to 6 months before having to vacate. Of course, the six-month rule was never enforced, so the cove kept getting busier with more and more drug boats. Waco offered the help. He went in one night and made his way around the 30 or so boats, which were loosely tied together. Waco found our black boat. He learned the owner was a guy people called Red. He was a dealer and let people use and pass out on board his boat afterwards. The next night, Waco went back, and we followed from a distance with the Coast Guard. We had Waco wired so we could hear everything on board. His plan was to get on with a few others to buy and use some heroin, and then just pass out. He would fake the shooting up part and pretend to fall asleep. Connolly and I listened in, hearing the details of the casual conversations going on from the other users as they bought and started prep. Soon enough, all the voices went quiet, including Waco's. A rough, agitated voice called out, asking if anyone was awake. There was no response. The voice, belonging to Red, laughed and said, "Good." We heard some shuffling. Then the engine on the boat revved into gear. The boat peeled out, leaving the cove behind. Waco had a GPS tracker in his shoe, so Conley and I watched the boat on a monitor as it headed out to sea. We followed from a distance. The Coast Guard's lights all turned off and went completely stealth. Conley and I continued listening in. After several minutes, the engine died down. There were sounds of chains rustling and clanking together. Waco's voice came on the mic in a hushed and frantic whisper.
"He's chaining us together. There's an anvil on one end."
Our captain flipped the lights and sirens on, and the boat gunned it towards the blip on our radar. Over the mic, we heard Red notice the sirens. He started the panic and, from what Waco told us, was about to toss the anvil over the side. but Waco was up and ready to fight. He surprised Red from behind and got him in a chokehold. When we arrived, Red was unconscious on the floor of the boat and Waco was sitting on his back. There were 5 users laying on the floor. They were all dead. Red had given them all spiked batches, and they had died minutes before. When we got back to land, interrogating Red was useless and terrifying. Useless because he said nothing, and terrifying because of how he said nothing. He had bitten off his tongue moments before we got him into the room. He was in the hospital for the next day and a half before we sat him down with a pencil and paper. We didn't really need Red to talk, though. There was more than enough evidence to put him away for the deaths of the 5 users on the boat. And then divers found more bodies along the same stretch Red boated on. Altogether, it appeared that Red was responsible for the deaths of over 50 people. And that didn't include the beach volleyball tournament, the seniors' home, or the junior high school. The thing I remembered most about my brief time sitting across from Red during the interview was his eyes. Just like Patty, I watched his face move and twitch and wrinkle, but his eyes were always the same empty black, holding my gaze. We never got a reason or motive for any of it. We found out he had been in and out of foster homes up until his 16th birthday. Coincidentally enough, there was a house fire which killed both his foster parents and 2 other kids living there. After that, Red disappeared for a few years, then got nabbed for an assault in a movie theater, and spent his 20s in and out of prison. Who knew how much destruction Red had caused over the course of his life? My 3rd experience with true evil was just as Conley was nearing his retirement. Poetically enough, it was our last case together. We had been investigating the individual abductions of 6 Caucasian women between 18 and 22 years old. It was a little old for grooming gangs, and we ruled out human trafficking. We had done a ton of legwork and repeat interviews with friends and family. No one went back on previous statements. Everyone was solid. We didn't have a single person of interest. We did have one connection between the girls. They all traveled in similar underground heavy metal and punk rock circles. They also appeared to have a similar fascination with Satanism. Connolly and I went back over the details of each disappearance and found they all coincided with a certain opening band that occasionally played at a weekly death metal show. They were called Helvit and were a Norwegian black metal band. They were known for covering themselves in what looked like blood and performing in masks. Each mask was different, but followed a typical design of a face with eyes, nose, and mouth. But the texture looked like dried skin. Dark wicker twigs stuck out of the back of the head, resembling a porcupine. The more we read of them, the more they became our suspects. Connolly and I got an address and decided to introduce ourselves. The place was on the outskirts of town, surrounded by a large plot of land and forest. We parked up the driveway, and I'll admit, the walk up to the house, I was feeling nervous. It was dusk, and the sky was a darkening gradient of orange to dark blue. The residence itself was a large old farmhouse. Death metal blared from somewhere inside, thudding out through the shuttered windows. There was a large black van parked out back and 2 sedans in the front. A scream erupted from the house, louder than the death metal music. I pulled my 9mm and Connolly pulled his .38. We called for backup and went in through the front door, which was unlocked. The interior had a staircase to the right that led upstairs, and a hallway to the left that led to the living room, dining room, and kitchen. More screams erupted along with the pounding music. We could tell the screams were coming from below us, and found a door leading to a staircase to the basement. The screams and music got louder and were joined by chanting. Connolly led, trigger-fingered, creeping his way down the stairs. As he got to the bottom, Connolly swung out to clear the room, but someone was there. A tall mountain of a man in a dark mechanic suit, wearing one of the group's eerie masks, swung down at Connolly. Connolly saw it coming, firing his .38 into the guy. My right ear blew out and my left was filled with ringing, chanting, and screaming. As I got my head back on, I saw that the man had swung down on Connolly with a hatchet, and it lodged in the Connolly's neck. He fell back, but continued firing into the far end of the basement. I let my 9mm lead me around the corner. There were old bedsheets hanging from the ceiling, obscuring my vision of the basement. The heavy metal kept pumping and the chanting grew, but the screams had stopped.
Extra Value Meals are back. That means 10 tender juicy McNuggets and medium fries and a drink are just $8. Only at McDonald's.
For a limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.
I wanted to check Connolly, but I needed to clear the room. I stepped over the body Connolly had shot and followed the chanting. It led me through the sheets and into a large opening. Dozens of red candles were lit. There was a circle drawn on the floor, and inside it was an inverted pentagram painting in what looked like blood. In the far corner, the ground was dirt, and I could see several graves protruding from the earth. At the center of the pentagram, a young woman wearing barely rags was chained to pegs on the ground, and had just given birth. On each point of the pentagram around her were what appeared to be remains of 5 recently delivered and now dead babies. Kneeling in front of the exhausted and crying woman with another band member, dressed similar to the previous Hulk, but smaller with a slightly different mask, he held the newest, just-delivered baby in his hands as it cried. There were 2 other figures in the room, one over each of the kneeling guy's shoulders. The one on the right was holding a large, traditional two-handed sledgehammer. The handle was thick wood and the mallet was solid iron, lined with carvings and covered in blood and innards. The guy on the left was holding an open book and had been guiding the others in the chant. We all stared at each other in some strange, horrific standoff. The guy with the sledgehammer pulled first, lifting it to swing at me. I leveled up on him and walked 2 rounds into his chest before turning to the other 2. The guy with the book threw it at me and lunged. I managed to get 2 more rounds off into him, but his momentum carried him through me and we hit the floor heavily. My head cracked hard and I saw the familiar stars rushing the edges of my vision. Everything sounded like it was underwater but was moving really fast. I managed to turn my head and saw the remaining band member, the one holding the baby. He had placed it on the ground in the center of the pentagram. He grabbed the sledgehammer from his dead friend and lifted it to slam down on the remaining baby. I didn't even realize it, but I still had my 9mm in my hand. Reflexively, I pulled the trigger repeatedly until it clicked empty. The final shot connected with the guy's head as he was about to swing down. He toppled back and the sledgehammer fell safely to the side. I don't remember much after that. I woke up in the hospital and was informed Connolly had died, as had all the band members. The baby and the young woman had survived though, so there was that. The investigation was taken over by 2 other detectives and revealed that the band had been taking women from shows, bringing them back to the farmhouse and trying to impregnate them. Once they had gotten the 6 pregnant, they planned a mass ritual sacrifice to be conducted after the final birth as an offering to the devil in some Faustian bargain. The other women had been killed after their deliveries and were buried in the far end of the basement. I never saw any of the band members' eyes when they were alive because of the masks. Though I'm sure if I did, they'd carry the same darkness as Patty's and Red's. I said I had seen true evil 3 times in my career, and that's true. But that last time, there was more to what happened than what I put in my reports. It's the reason I retired immediately after the case. It's the thing that made me realize there was an evil I couldn't even begin to comprehend. I had seen it right when I got into the basement and leveled off my 9mm at the 3 men. There was something else down there with us. It was floating in the middle of the circle, kind of like black smoke, but it stayed in place, wafting together before separating and reconnecting. Bolts of red electricity shot through it. The smoke got larger as the chanting grew. It pulsed and expanded and reached out, forming into the shape of a body. What gives me nightmares now is thinking about if that last baby had been killed and the smoke finished solidifying. I'm terrified that whatever it would have manifested into would have shown me another realm of evil.